Today's cases will be called as previously announced, and the times will be as allotted to council. The first case today is number 25-1340 and number 25-1544, Walter Wambugo Maturi versus Pamela J. Bondi. At this time, would counsel for the petitioner please introduce herself on the record to begin?
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court, Chelsea Eddy on behalf of the petitioner. Chief Barron, may I please reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal?
You may.
Okay, thank you. So this case essentially raises two primary claims. The first claim is past persecution on account of family, specifically petitioner's relationship to his father, and the presumption of well-founded fear of future persecution. And the second claim is with regard to humanitarian asylum on account of other serious harm. So starting with the first claim, past persecution on account of family, the agency failed to consider petitioner's fear of the police, that he'll be targeted by the Kenyan officials or the police on account of his relationship to his father, when the agency considered the whether the government rebutted petitioner's presumptive well-founded fear of future persecution. An asylum applicant can demonstrate asylum if they've demonstrated past persecution on account of a protected ground, and that in turn triggers a presumption of well-founded fear of future persecution on account of that same statutory ground.
Counsel?
Yes.
From reading the briefs, and we'll obviously ask the government this, but it seems that there isn't really a dispute about the legal standard, and perhaps the big issue is whether this argument was exhausted. So I was just wondering if we could turn to that right away. And I read the brief to the BIA, and I see the quotes that you've included in your brief. They're obviously accurate representations, but can you just address, is it really enough for the BIA to have understood that that argument was being made, because it's sort of a sentence here and a sentence there, but not necessarily all in one place under the relevant legal standard as you've laid it out. So can you address for us what your best argument is and why it was fully preserved such that the BIA would have known the argument was being made?
Of course. So we would first agree with your proposition that there is no dispute as to the legal standard. And I know you said you did go through the BIA brief, but I would just point to a few sentences on specifically on pages 95 and 96 of the administrative record, where petitioner states that his risks come from the Mungiki itself, and as described supra, from the police, who may presume he is Mungiki on account of his family relationship to his father and his forced participation in an animal blood drinking ritual. He also, on the previous page, states that previous actions by Kenyan police against Mungiki members, actual and imputed, have resulted in serious violence. So it is throughout the fear of the police and tied to his ethnicity and his relationship to his father does run throughout the BIA brief. And
I think that the question I have, though, is when I look at the headings under which those arguments are made, that's sort of the source of my question. So for instance, and please tell me if I'm wrong, but the relevant heading would be at the bottom of page 94, and it talks about the IJ didn't properly review reasonably available country condition standards, and respondents repeated history of being denied adequate police protection. So is the heading really enough to let the BIA understand that the sentences that you've quoted are making the legal argument that you're now making to us?
Regarding the standard?
That it's about fear of the police as a separate type of harm because of the imputed.
I see, yes. A petitioner's position is that it is enough to raise that legal argument, but the court also does not even have to address whether the BIA actually knew the correct legal standard. It could simply determine that the BIA erred in failing to address the fear of the police. And so the fact that petitioner raises a fear of the police, which is throughout his both the brief, and then I would also argue in the underlying record evidence as well, pretty pervasively, the court could just address vacate and remand on the failure to address the claim without having to address whether the BIA actually knew the correct legal standard.
Just so I'm tracking this, there's no claim of past persecution by the police.
That's correct.
So how does that affect what you just said? In other words, if the claim of fear of future harm from the police is not predicated on a presumption of a well-founded fear of being persecuted based on past persecution of this status, what would the claim at all even be with respect to the police? Just a pure forward-looking future harm claim? Is that even articulated?
If I'm understanding your question, with regard to the past persecution claim, the harm by the police only needs to be on account of the same statutory ground that demonstrated the past persecution.
I understand, and you were saying to Judge Rickleman, I thought, maybe that wasn't articulated as the legal theory. But nonetheless, there was a claim of fear of harm from the police that wasn't addressed.
Correct.
If that's right, I'm trying to understand, what is that claim then? Is that a claim of just general future harm from the police based on what?
I see what you're saying. I do think the fear of the police on account of his family relationship is articulated in the brief. It said, like, as the quote that I just said, his risks come from the Mungiki itself and from the police, who may presume he is Mungiki on account of his family relationship.
Yeah, and so then that, and then, so, okay, so I guess then there's, if that was articulated, are you suggesting, even if we thought it wasn't articulated, that that was tied to a presumption rooted in the past persecution, nonetheless, it's still a claim of fear of future persecution based on the police that wasn't addressed?
I'm not sure I'm following their question, but essentially...
Well, there's a claim of past persecution.
Correct.
The police were not involved in that past persecution.
Correct.
That generates a presumption of future persecution.
Correct.
You could be making a claim that's drawing on that presumption. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
If you are, with respect to the police, now you're saying that presumption extends to when we consider the claim of the fear of future persecution from the police. So you go in with an advantage because of the presumption. I thought you were saying to Judge Ruppelman, even if we thought that all had not been articulated to the BIA, there was still a contention about fear of persecution by the police on account of Mungiki status. That was articulated to the BIA.
Yes, yes. And I think I might have potentially not been clear in my answer to Judge Rickleman. So where I was going with that was, even if the court disagrees that there's an exhaustion issue, or that the BIA knew the legal standard and there's no issue with regard to the legal standard, we did the issue of fear of the police on account of his relationship to his father as tied to that past persecution claim, that the BIA just failed to address that claim, even assuming they did apply the correct legal standard and knew the correct legal standard. And petitioner's position is that both of those claims are exhausted and addressed, but if the court would not have to reach the legal standard issue and could just address the BIA's failure to address the police claim. I will also note, however, though, with regard to the humanitarian asylum claim and other serious harm, the police persecution in that sense does not have to be tied to a protected ground. There is no nexus component there. So if there's any exhaustion issue, excuse me, or nexus issue, but the fear of the police is legitimate and real, that could factor into the other serious harm, and petitioner could still receive a humanitarian asylum on that ground. And
So if I'm following, your position is that what was preserved was the contention that there was a well-founded fear of persecution by the police based on his status, and that in assessing that, there should be a presumption of the well-founded fear with respect to the police, even though the police did not engage in the past persecution. That's a preserved claim in your view.
Correct.
Okay, and then second, also preserved is an independent claim that even if he doesn't get the presumption, there was still a well-founded fear of persecution claim based on the police, based on his status. Correct?
Correct.
And then third, for the humanitarian, there's also a preserved claim of just fear of the police persecuting him.
That's correct.
Based on that status.
Yes.
Those three are all, you say, preserved, and none were addressed by the BIA.
Correct. Yes.
Anything else?
those are the primary claims. Yes.
Can I just to
oh certainly
stay on this issue? Just one more question on this. You know, again, I'm just trying to figure out what is fair in terms of what the BIA could have understood from this lengthy brief. And the arguments that you were quoting to us and the pages you were citing, again, the heading under which they come, which was heading G in the brief, mm-hmm. is that the IJ misapplied the unwilling or unable to protect standard and was wrong in finding that the government is willing and able to protect this respondent. And to my understanding, that is when the discussion of the police targeting the his ethnicity comes in. So it seems to me to have been framed, even though there is discussion of his fear of the police, it seems to be framed under a completely different legal argument, which is, was the government unwilling and unable to protect him? So just to sort of try one more time, what is your best response why the particular legal claim that you're now making to us, which is different, it's not about the government being unwilling and unable to protect him, which is part of a different, you know, a different mm-hmm. part of the analysis. It's about just persecution by the police themselves. Why was that clearly made to the BIA given that heading? Could you just address the heading?
So I think you stated heading G, and I would say that the arguments I was citing are under heading I, which is at the bottom of page 94 of the administrative record. That the IJ did not properly review reasonably available country conditions, standards, nor the respondent's repeated history of being denied adequate police protection, coming to the wrongful conclusion that there is no reasonable fear of future persecution. So
yes, you are right. That's there. It's a different file. I couldn't quite tell if yeah. that's a subset. I mean, I'm just being honest. I couldn't tell if it was a subsection because there's no H.
Yeah, understandable.
But in any event, neither one of those headings to me seem to be a bit framed in terms of the legal argument that mm-hmm. you're now making to us.
And I think that if I think the heading I think even if that doesn't raise that the BIA failed to apply the correct legal standard, I think it still raises the BIA's failure to consider the a petitioner's fear of the police. And I especially given that it's under the no reasonable fear of future persecution, so the heading does highlight that we're talking about his fear of future persecution, and then later on within that heading twice discusses the fear of the police on account of his father's relationship to his father and his alleged participation in the Mungiki tribe.
Okay, so you're focusing on the last clause in I that you think is enough to give the framing that you're now bringing to us.
Correct, yes.
Okay,
yeah.
Thank you.
Can I ask you just one question on the legal standard?
Yes.
If the past persecution is not committed by the entity that's now the source of the future persecution, mm-hmm. is it the case that the presumption of past persecution extends to our consideration of the likelihood of that future persecution occurring by that entity?
Yes, Your Honor.
What establishes that?
So the legal standard is that the past persecution and the future persecution only have to be related on account of the same protected ground.
That I understand, but the presumption of future persecution comes from the fact of the past persecution. And mm-hmm. it just seems there's a certain logic when X is responsible for the past persecution to presume that X will keep doing it unless somebody says otherwise. But it seems a little different to say X persecuted me in the past, therefore you should presume that I would fear Y would do it mm-hmm. in the future. But why? Well, we have no reason to think Y has ever done it in the past, so why would we presume Y would do it in the future? It's true that there's reason to think that status is the type of thing that is the subject of persecution. But as to the new entity, why would we presume that entity would engage in the persecution when it hasn't done so in the past?
A few responses, Your Honor. I think first, just looking at the text of the regulation, it only focuses on whether the presumption to have a well-founded fear of future persecution is on the basis of the original claim, and that language...
The original claim is, it depends how you slice it, right?
It does, yes, and I think...
What justifies slicing it in the way you do which is as long as the claim relates to the status, then we presume anybody will persecute on the basis of that status, even if there's no indication that that entity has ever done persecution on that basis before.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't seem to be very logical.
So I have a few responses. First, just looking at starting with like the text of the regulation, the original claim is our interpretation is essentially referring back to the previous sentence where the regulation states that past persecution is demonstrated if the applicant shows persecution on account of, and then it lists those five protected grounds. And so on the basis of the original claim is reverting back to those five protected grounds. And then similarly, if you look down at subsection A, where it discusses the fundamental change, the department's burden to rebut that presumption based on a fundamental change in circumstances, it only discusses the department's requirement to rebut on account of one of those five protected grounds. And if the same persecutor was required, you would presume that the department could also rebut by demonstrating the persecutor has changed if that was a requirement. And then that interpretation, that it's only the enumerated ground that's required, is further confirmed by several other sources. We have the Federal Register, which states that a person who has established past persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group or political opinion shall be presumed to have a well-founded fear of future persecution on account of those same grounds. And then the USCIS manual has a very similar quote. But I think perhaps the most compelling also is the BIA case, Matter of AT. It's the third case in that Matter of AT series from 2009, and they specifically state that the persecutor can be different. They say the specific agent of future persecution need not necessarily be identical to the specific agent of past persecution, and we agree with DHS that the respondent's claim does not fail because her past and future persecutors are not identical. And so taking AT2, which is the...
What was the dissimilarity in Matter of AT?
Matter of AT was involving a woman who had undergone female genital mutilation, FGM, and it actually happened at such a young age that she didn't remember who it was, and then the future persecution was her allegation, which was based on potential forced marriage to her cousin and potential violence that her father might engage in if she failed to go through with this forced marriage. So those persecutors are clearly different. And I'll also point to there's a couple other cases, a few other in the FGM context where I think it was the Third Circuit and I believe the Ninth Circuit.
Okay.
Similarly found that the petitioner had undergone FGM. In one of the cases, it was actually the persecutors were like three women from the tribe. And then they remanded to the BIA to consider whether they would experience future persecution. And they clearly stated that the protected ground was PSG, in that case, like a gender tribe PSG, and the future persecutors was potentially like domestic violence, sex trafficking, rape, and in those situations, like if it's a domestic violence context, the persecutor is probably going to be someone different than the person that committed the FGM, and so they remanded for on that ground. So really the nexus in that, or the relational factor between the past and future persecution was that statutory ground rather than the persecutor. If the court has no further questions, we rest on our brief. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the respondent please come to the podium and introduce herself on the record to begin?
May it please the court, Andrea Jeevis on behalf of the Attorney General. This court should deny the instant petition for review because substantial evidence supports the agency's denial of asylum and withholding of removal. But before discussing the merits, I'd like to focus on the fact that respondent believes these claims were not properly exhausted. As Judge Rickleman mentioned, petitioner has changed her claim, or I'm sorry, as Judge Rickleman focused on page 96, and focused on the repeated history of being denied adequate police protection. That was the original claim before the agency, and what is not the claim today. And I'd like to go through the procedural history because I think it will highlight how petitioner has not exhausted his claim. Before the immigration judge, petitioner appeals with counsel number one and says he fears returning to Kenya because of his political opinion and religion. He presents one particular social group, a minor who must obey his father. Petitioner, the IJ asks for any other social groups. He replies no. The IJ then, petitioner testifies. He says, I'm applying for asylum. I fear my father, his family members, and the community I come from. He does not mention the police. Throughout the testimony, his focus is on his father. At the end of the direct testimony, petitioner mentions my father, my family relative, and then even mentions the police, but there's no follow-up testimony. Then, before the BIA, he has eight arguments in his notice of appeal, none of which mention the police. And when he was testifying before the immigration judge, just to go back, I'm sorry, he talks about the police in the fact that his mother went to go report the incident with his father, yet the police was not willing to protect him. And that was the only claim that he could possibly say was raised before the immigration judge or the board. He talks about in his 45-page appeal brief, which Judge Ruckelman's mentioned, he mentions the police, he fears the police and mentions this clear testimony. This is on page 69. Yet he never has one record citation to anything regarding his clear evidence. Then he talks about the IJ's failure to develop the record. He mentions the police declined to investigate his claims. That's sticking to the original position that, if any, this court could find regarding the police, it would be that the police did not protect him, which goes back to the subsection Judge Ruckelman mentioned, which was the claim of the repeated history of being denied adequate police protection. That was his original claim. That's not what he's arguing today. He's arguing that the police will impute Mungiki status on him. That's a totally different claim.
But he says that in the brief.
In his opening brief or his?
In his brief to the BIA.
Right, in the 45-page appeal brief,
right.
Which
so
on page 90.
If I asked it this way, if the BIA had found the issue preserved, would that have been error?
That would have been fact-finding, which then it would have had to go back, to the IJ.
If the BIA had found the issue preserved on this record, would that have been error by the BIA?
Yes, because the IJ didn't even focus on the police or mention it. Is that the question you're asking?
Well, I'm trying to, the way you're framing this, it's as if the BIA made a finding of non-exhaustion.
No, the BIA said
correct.
Nothing because it's,
correct.
Yeah.
So suppose it's just unclear whether it was exhausted. If the BIA had found it was preserved, that wouldn't have been a mistake, would have been a fair judgment on their part that it was properly raised to us, and then we would consider it.
Correct, if the board
But the BIA didn't say one way or the other. So one way to handle this might be to vacate and remand, let the BIA make a finding on whether it was exhausted or not. Right? We're parsing various snippets of a brief. There's language in it that does state the claim. There's headings that suggest maybe that's not what was being said. The BIA, rather than saying, you're talking about police protection, but that's not developed or that wasn't exhausted, makes no statement whatsoever, just doesn't even mention it. They then fairly say, well, they just never considered that aspect of the claim. Since it wasn't addressed, but it's in the brief, we could just vacate and remand for the BIA to address that aspect of it. If it wants to find it waived, it can.
Your Honor, so you could do that. However, the government strongly disagree that this wasn't ever in petitioner's claim. It's petitioner's burden for relief. They present their claims to the IJ. They present nothing about this police imputing Mungiki status.
Well,
they don't even mention
When you say nothing.
They mention the police twice.
And they say that the police will impute that status.
Not before the immigration judge. It says the police did not protect us. That is what the problem is. Then it goes to the board, and then it talks about police.
We have two different issues. First question is, was it raised to the BIA?
In what?
The BIA didn't, in the briefing to the BIA.
In a 45-page appeal brief.
Okay, but
mentioned a couple lines. Oh, sorry, Your Honors.
The BIA did not find it was raised to the BIA, but not exhausted before the IJ, correct?
Correct.
Right. So before we get to the question of whether we can affirm the BIA on the ground that it was not exhausted to the IJ, we would have to decide whether the claim was raised to the BIA. I thought you were arguing it was not raised to the BIA.
It's not raised adequately to the BIA,
okay.
Correct.
We don't have a finding by the BIA on that score.
Correct.
There's just no reference to it.
Correct.
Yet the brief to the BIA does state in a sentence the exact thing they're now saying to us, which is that the police would attribute that status to the petitioner based on the father's familial relation and persecute him in consequence.
Yes, there is a statement or two. However, there could also be viewed differently and say they're focused.
So why not point that out and let the BIA address whether it did overlook it or whether it decides it was just not adequately developed and is waived, since the BIA hasn't said one thing or the other about that.
Correct. That is one path. But the government would still argue that it has not been adequately raised. I mean, on page 65, in the introduction section of this appeal brief that we're speaking of, it says, sadly, the immigration judge never heard respondent's full narrative. And if you go to the bottom, the immigration judge did not know about the challenges the Kenyan government faces in controlling the Mungiki, nor the police roundups, without due process of perceived Mungiki, especially for political reasons. Petitioner, in his introduction page, is admitting that he was never raised the perceived Mungiki to the board. I'm sorry, to the immigration judge, in his appeal brief to the board.
So the board could have found waiver. Could it have overlooked the waiver if it wanted to?
Yes, because there were so many arguments in this 45-page.
No, I mean, could it have purposely ignored the waiver and addressed the claim? Could the BIA have addressed the claim?
It could have, but
they didn't. So our question is whether it's exhausted in front of the BIA so that we can hear it. But if the BIA never even made a ruling on waiver, I'm going back to Chief Judge Barron's point, why wouldn't we have them sort that out?
That is one avenue the court could take.
But why wouldn't we have them do it?
Because I don't even think you need to get there. Petitioner is presented one claim before the IJ. The focus of his claim has always been my father, the Mungiki peers, and the Mungiki people. And now they're saying that in the police, whenever they focused on the police, it has been in the way that he fears they will not protect him from his father. That's been the crux of his claim. Now they're coming before the court and changing the claim to the police are impute the Mungiki.
When you say the court, you mean us or the BIA?
Sorry, this court. This court. Now it's coming before with a new claim.
I thought before the BIA, they specifically said what he fears is that the police will persecute him because they'll think he has that status based on his father.
That is not the government's position. The government's position is that...
I'm not asking what the position of the government. I'm just saying, isn't that statement in the brief?
There's a few statements before the BIA. However, it's a 45-page brief with 18 subsection arguments. The board is evaluating all of that brief. And the way that the petitioner framed it, even in the introduction, was the immigration judge never heard it on page 65 and 66.
Counsel, I think what we're struggling with, and as I understand your argument, you're arguing to us the BIA didn't even know the argument was there, and therefore they had no reason to decide whether there was exhaustion or not, or whether they should overlook it, etc. But what we're asking is, given the BIA silence and the fact that the brief does have sentences, at least in several places, as you acknowledge, what should we do? It seems the question is basically, was there enough in the brief that it seems that the BIA should have addressed it? And given that they didn't, the prudent course for us would be to remand. So I guess what I'm asking is, in your view, when is there enough to send it back to the BIA? Because there's clearly more than nothing. This isn't a brief where it wasn't raised at all in any way. So can you help us sort that out?
Correct. And I think that that's the different when you're having a 45-page brief, there's motion to reconsider, testimony from his mother and himself, and a few sentences mentioning the police imputing Mungiki status, as opposed to the crux of the claim and the hundreds of other pages in the records which do not mention that. I mean, I guess the question is, if this court finds those two sentences amongst all this other evidence where petitioner bears the burden of proof is enough, and if the court would find that's enough, then I guess they would have to go back to the board. The government's position is that's not enough. It was petitioner's burden of proof. He presents his claim. He mentions before the immigration judge the police twice, and always in the context of they did not protect me. They mention in the opening pages of his brief to the board. Sadly, the immigration judge never heard about the controlling the Mungiki or the police roundups or the imputed status. Then he cites those two sentences on page 96 regarding that was enough to bring it to the board. In a 45-page brief, all this evidence, if this court were to find that those two sentences were enough, then yes, it would probably need to take it back to the board. But again, of all this evidence that the petitioner bears the burden of, there's two sentences.
And can I ask you, if we sent it back on this question of the legal standard with respect to the past persecution having been committed not by the police, does the presumption of a well-founded fear of persecution then extend to our consideration of the likelihood of future persecution by the police?
No, it would go to what has been presented before it, which was in the government's position is the father, the Mungiki ceremony or peer, and his Mungiki peers.
What about matter of AT, which suggests that it doesn't have to be identical, even if the future persecutor hasn't engaged in the past persecution? If there's evidence of the past persecution based on a certain status, the presumption that that status will be the source of future persecution persists even as to a non-identical future persecutor.
For in the terms of DHS rebutting the presumption, is that what you're referencing, or the humanitarian asylum?
Rebutting the presumption.
Okay. No, Your Honor, it would have to be so. The standard is that it must prove that the conditions have changed so dramatically as to undermine the well-foundedness of fear, focusing on what was the past persecution. The police was never a focus of the past persecution. It was his father, again, the Mungiki ceremony,
and then
the Mungiki
peers. How does that match up with matter of AT, which is what your opponent cited when I asked them the same question, which is the BIA decision that suggests the future persecutor needn't be the same actor that engaged in the past persecution, as long as there's no indication that the same ground wouldn't be a source of concern.
And then we would go back to the changed country conditions if they would include the new source of harm as matter of AT, then you would go to the changed country conditions, which would support the claim that DHS has met its burden.
And just help walk me through that a little bit. How is that true with respect to the police?
Well, first of all, the numerous country conditions shows that the Mungiki, first of all, petitioner's Christian. And yes, if the court would say that he has exhausted his claim that the police would impute Mungiki status to him, even though majority of Kenya is Christian, there's several articles saying that Mungiki no longer exists. The police have arrested Mungiki members. That would go to that claim, but there's several articles saying it's no longer exists. So you'd have to focus on the changed country conditions, but that would have to go back to the board to address that if this court would find that that claim has not been exhausted.
Thank you.
Counsel, just to confirm though, do you disagree with the petitioner on the basics of the legal standard that the well-founded fear of future persecution does not have to be in the same form or by the same individuals for him to still get the benefit of the presumption?
Yes, let me just. I would like to cite a case. Just one second, Your Honor.
Sure.
Yes, the Mendez v. Garland, which talks about the statute, which talks about in the circumstances he no longer has a well-founded fear. And once you would show DHS, and I hope this is the answer to your question, please let me know if it's not. Then once DHS proves, then it goes back to petitioner for it. They bear the burden to show those new sources of harm. So was that your question, Your Honor?
I think my question was a little different, which is okay. Just the very basic legal standard on well-founded fear, which I thought you agreed to, and I just want to make sure that's true, which is that once there is a finding of past persecution, as there was here, the well-founded fear does not have to be from the same exact individual or in the same exact form of persecution.
Oh, citing matter of AT.
Yeah. Do you agree? Yes. Do you agree with that?
No. The government would say that no. That you have, in order to overcome the past persecution and establish the well-founded fear, it has to be the same sources of harm.
Your view is it has to be the same individual, that's your position?
No, I'm sorry. I don't think I'm understanding your question. I apologize. Can you say it one more time?
Sure. Let me try one more time. I understood the legal standard to be well established, that once past persecution has been established, as it was here, that a well-founded fear of future persecution,
correct,
did not have to be fear of persecution by the same exact individual or the same exact type of harm.
Correct. Okay. Yes. Sorry. Your Honor, I thought we were talking about something else. My apologies.
Thank you very much.
And if this court, yes.
You agree with that?
I'm sorry, I agree.
You agree with what Judge Rickleman just described?
The matter of AT?
Yes.
Yes, that it could be possibly other sources of harm.
Okay.
However, the government would not agree.
That?
There are other sources of harm.
As a factual matter,
as
not
a factual,
as a legal standard matter.
Sorry, yes, sorry.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions, Your Honor?
No, thank you.
Thank you, counsel. At this time, would counsel for the petitioner please reintroduce herself on the record? She has a 2-minute rebuttal.
Chelsea Eddy on behalf of petitioner. Just to be brief, with regards to exhaustion, exhaustion should be interpreted in favor of the petitioner. That's a First Circuit case, Sinoto v. Gonzalez, which was cited in the reply brief. And then if exhaustion is a concern for the court, there is no exhaustion issue with regard to humanitarian asylum and receiving in which petitioner has demonstrated past persecution and would receive humanitarian asylum if they demonstrate other serious harm. So as there's no exhaustion issue, the court would be able to reach all the humanitarian asylum issues if there's a concern about that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes argument in this case.